From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. More big changes for GE. The huge company relocated its headquarters to Boston last year, and today CEO Jeff Immelt announced he's stepping down.
16 years is a long time to run this company. Even though I love you all dearly, it's long enough. And change is good.
Also today, the latest in our conversations with Democratic gubernatorial hopefuls, Newton Mayor Seti Warren talks about why he believes a single-payer healthcare system and free public college are best for the state.
What is the cost of not doing this, of our people and our residents? We need to make sure that we redefine what it means to make ends meet in Massachusetts.
Plus, should kids be drinking chocolate milk in schools?
Chocolate milk is a treat. You don't need flavored milk. It's just a response, I believe, to the market.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A major change at the world's 14th biggest publicly traded company. GE CEO Jeff Immelt is stepping down. He'll be replaced by John Flannery, the current president of GE Healthcare. Now, Immelt has led the company for 16 years, and here he is speaking today to GE employees.
16 years is a long time to run this company. Even though I love you all dearly, it's long enough. And change is good.
And Immelt himself led GE through quite a period of change through the financial crisis. He also oversaw the sale of GE Capital and invested in a digital transformation of the company, most notably by moving GE World headquarters to Boston last year. Well, joining us now with more is Asma Khalid. She heads Bostonomics, WBUR's business and technology team. Hello, Asma.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, Immelt, as I read the list of things he's done, he's credited with really remaking GE, but there's also been a lot of pressure on him to step down. I mean, financial performance. Performance-wise?
Yeah, you know, Meghna, it is really kind of a mixed bag. I mean, and to be fair, I mean, Immelt didn't exactly become CEO at the easiest moment in history. I mean, he literally took over this company 5 days before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And you know, in a chat today with employees, he talked about his tenure at the company and told his staff that in his mind, GE has become more resilient over the past 16 years.
I got this job in 2001, and for really, I'd say all of the country, or certainly all of American business, we lived in a time period of complete certainty, economic perfection, right? And then we woke up and we faced Enron and the 9/11 tragedy and the power bubble and a time period of just disruption and change.
And so, Meghna, he talked about the 90s being just this era, right, of complete sort of economic perfection. And then he was thrust into this sort of volatile world, right, where not only did he sort of experience the recession and whatnot, but there was also a lot of digital transformation during that time period. And it is true that he shepherded the company through these rather turbulent times. But as you suggested, you know, there are persistent questions about financial profitability for GE.
Okay, so let's talk more about that, because as I said at the top here, it's also still, according to Forbes, the 14th biggest publicly traded company in the world. So what do we mean by
Meghna, it is. It's this giant of a company, right? It's been around for 125 years. And so it's got this reputation. And when you think about what makes GE unique, and we heard this today, even in some of the conference calls that I was listening to, that it's this quest for innovation, whether that meant the light bulb or, you know, in current times, whether that means an MRI machine. But some investors would say that GE has grown too big, that it's this conglomerate that now needs to be broken up. And during the financial crisis, we saw how much of GE was sort of tied, particularly through GE Capital, was kind of tethered to the banking system. And I would say that one way that you sort of assess, right, a company's financial profitability is to look at GE's stock price. And I would say, you know, you can look at what the Dow Jones Industrial Average has done over this period in time. And Meghna, I want to say I did some calculations. It looked like it was up over 120% during this time frame. Just overall, GE has underperformed sort of exponentially during this time period compared to the market.
Right. I mean, you and I just during the newscast here were looking at the numbers here specifically. I've got some specific numbers for those finance heads out there that on September 8th, 2001, when Jeff Immelt took over, or the day after he took over, GE's share price was $39.35 at the close of trading that day. Just last Friday, it was $27.94. So indeed, an overall slight drop. over his 16-year tenure. But as you pointed out, there's been incredible ups and downs, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but what about the new CEO, John Flannery? What are we to expect from him?
Well, Meghna, he's really a private equity guy. He went to the Wharton School of Business at Penn, and he joined GE 30 years ago. He actually started out at GE Capital. What's interesting to me is that he's had a lot of experience working around the globe, Latin America, East Asia, India, and one of the board members today explained that in choosing the new CEO, they were really looking for a global person. And that's, you know, sort of what they found attractive about John. The past few years, he's been in charge of GE Healthcare, and he talked about that being a possible area of growth, particularly with digital innovation. He also did point out that he will be moving to Boston, and he claims to be a Red Sox fan. But Meghna, I also, that last line, I sort of am also like, well, you're also a businessman.
Exactly. And so what about how history is going to judge Jeff Immelt?
You know, Meghna, I don't know if I want to be that person to make that calculation, right? I will say that if you look at the company's stock price, it hasn't been strong, right? You know, the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that among the current companies on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, during the time frame that Immelt was in charge, from 2001 to 2017, GE had the worst performance. And to be fair, there are some companies that are no longer a part of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But some analysts would actually make the case that Immelt has actually helped reposition the company, that he's actually leaving a GE that is less vulnerable than the one that he inherited. And John Flannery, the new CEO, seems to agree. He spoke about that today.
I have just tremendous respect for Jeff. I've had the privilege of working under his leadership for directly for 16 years and have known him for much longer. He's transformed the company. I think in many ways people underappreciate the changes that have been he's made to the company to simplify it, to strengthen the portfolio, and frankly, the courage it took to make a number of those decisions, including things like exiting GE Capital.
So nice words there from Flannery for his predecessor, Jeff Immelt. But just to circle back to something you were saying earlier about Flannery being being a private equity guy, I mean, did he say specific things in that call today about where he might target continuing GE's transformation and how?
Well, Meghna, the one thing that caught my ear a lot is that both on a call with investors as well as in an employee conversation that was broadcast, he said that he intends to look at the company's entire portfolio.
I want to start with a fresh look around the company overall. And I think with a sense of urgency. So there's so many things we do well and have always done well. And there's clearly some areas we need to improve on and improve on, I think, quickly. So no one's happy with the stock price right now or some of the cash, you know, pictures that we've had. We know we can be better at those things. I want to focus on those things.
And what exactly that means, Meghna, I'm not entirely sure. But he did say that his focus the next few months is going to be on listening to investors, customers, and employees to try to figure out what's next.
Well, that's Asma Khalid. She leads our business and technology team, Bostonomics. Follow them at Twitter at Bostonomics. That's O-M-I-X, right?
Thank you, Meghna.
She's bringing us up to speed on the big news today that GE CEO Jeff Immelt will be stepping down. Asma, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
All right, let's get some more analysis on how Immelt's retirement really fits into that bigger picture of GE, what Asma was telling us there. Here is Jeff Immelt today on the company's Facebook Live video.
We've launched some of the most important new products in our history. We've continued to grow this great global franchise into the future. We've led a digital revolution in a place that we really face the future with great confidence, and we've executed financially.
David McGee is author of Jeff Immelt and the New GE Way, Innovation, Transformation, and Winning in the 21st Century, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Big day for Boston with a change.
Yeah, it's a really big day. Okay, so first of all, give us your sense as to what this means for GE. I mean, you've written about Immelt, you've looked at his tenure for a long time. How big is this for the company?
It's big because this is there's a new direction coming, and I think Flannery said we'll move fast in making some analysis. And essentially, GE operates with if you look at their history over 100 years, there haven't been many CEOs. There's not many leaders, and they really get a long rope when they take that job, and they're expected to take the long view of delivering shareholder value. If that means restructuring a company, if that means, you know, whatever direction they need to go in, Jeff Immelt had to take the long view on really solidifying the company's foundation because it had gotten very shaky. At the moment he's handing over the reins, what it means is Flannery's charge is get the return for shareholders.
Can I just jump in here?
One clear charge.
Yeah, so David, I want to jump in here because I think what you're saying is so extraordinarily important. I mean, Jeff Immelt had, as CEO, had to ride the worst ups and downs that his company and the market have seen, you know, since the Great Depression. As you said, his job was to shore up the foundations of GE. I mean, in a way, is he being pushed out, or is he being asked to step down, or what? Because it seems like he did his job, and now it's like all the focus is going to be on shareholder value.
Right. Well, investors do like to get their return, and you know, he pushed out and him leaving by choice, it's really a combination of factors. He's planned on leaving. He never planned on doing more than 20 years ever. And it's been clear that the company was looking at a succession plan for the last couple of years. So what happened now is in 2017, as the stock market has got a little bit of hint of the 1990s again, mm-hmm. with this kind of go-go sense, and there's GE not responding stock-wise at all. This 6 months in these go-go, you know, stock market environment for equities pretty much just escalated. So he was leaving anyway. He was already on the back end of his tenure. If the stock was really performing and the earnings were performing right now, he would probably ride it out another year or two. So it just kind of moved it up a little bit.
Yeah, I take your point. I mean, the numbers do tell a kind of a dour tale, right? The GE stock rose, what, 11%? During Immelt's tenure, but the overall market up more than almost 120%. But, you know, there are lots of ways to deliver shareholder value, right? You don't necessarily have to strengthen the company and deliver shareholder, but you can still deliver shareholder value. I mean, I wonder what this means specifically for GE as a business. It wants to be a leader in what Immelt was calling a digital industrialization of the company.
One problem I've seen is that investors as a whole haven't completely understood what GE is doing. I mean, he can meet with analysts and they get it, but when you have multiple focuses like you do at a conglomerate like this, you really better be spinning off massive amounts of cash. We saw stocks get stagnant in companies like Walmart that weren't really going anywhere. And Walmart stock didn't start moving again until they really convinced Wall Street that they were a technology company and going head-to-head against Amazon. I think GE's had a hard time telling that story. They're in healthcare. They're in jet engines. People just aren't really sure what they are. And if you're going to be that, you'd better spin off just surprising, delightful amounts of cash. Jack Welch had a vehicle to do that. It was called the financial arm, GE
right.
Capital.
No, continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you because I think you're making a good point. He had that at the time, and he did look to GE Capital to help keep shareholders happy, and that, of course, is one of the things that Immelt had to let go of.
That's right. You know, nothing is usually ever as bad as it appears, and nothing is usually as good as it appears either, and I think history has revealed that Jack Welch was operating in a different environment. He was able to use GE Capital to, I don't want to say distort as in he was doing something wrong. It's just the way games were played a little bit more in that day. They had favorable things happening of exchange rates and real estate between continents. You had a lot of currency ways that you could exploit, and because they were a global business, GE was able to use its capital arm when it really worked to its advantage to deliver some delights in its earnings reports. Every quarter they could just make some shift or move some giant piece of real estate, get some currency valuation advantage, and it was really easy to surprise and delight. And then when Jeff inherited it, it not only couldn't deliver the surprise and the delight, it was like an 8 million pound anvil on his back that he had to shed quick.
Right. I mean, you keep coming to this point, which, in my in my view, is so very important because, you know, I think a lot of people hearing this are saying, well, great. The focus on shareholder value for GE means we're going to be seeing a lot of financial shell games going on, whereas what GE was doing or trying to do under Immelt, and I'm not lionizing him here, but
sure.
It's like actually be a company that makes stuff for the 21st century.
I think that what you'll see with Flannery, he does have to move fast. I think a lot of his initial actions will be divesting some things that are a drag, and maybe looking at, is the company, does it have higher value if some parts are, maybe focus is, you know, you get an industrial focus, and maybe healthcare is split off. I mean, those are some of the hard questions he's going to ask, but you could do those kind of thing in today's environment with a high-flying stock market that could deliver value that aren't having to go back to tricks of smoke and mirrors and finance.
Okay. I mean, I suppose, forgive me if I maintain a healthy shred of skepticism. We've just been through too many ups and downs here as a company and as an economy. Now, a little bit earlier today, there was a blip. There was a moment where people were talking about, you know, could a breakup of GE be on the horizon? Do you see that as any kind of possibility?
I do think it's a possibility because I think right now, if you were to take the most valuable parts of GE and stand them on their own, and if you look at a lot of the talent the company has, middle management up, shareholder value would absolutely be returned. And that was not to be Jeff's – he'd done his work in helping the company get its foundation. I'll give you a little hint of how this goes. It was a CEO of GE by the name of Reginald Jones. And most people in America don't know the name Reg Jones. He's got a beautiful obit online you can still find in the New York Times. But Reg Jones was the CEO of GE for 9 years until 1981. And under Reg Jones, the GE stock declined 21% under his 9 years. But what Reg Jones did in that 9 years was he transformed the company. He made it much more global. He really got its foundation set. And then Jack Welch took over. And a lot of things happened in a wonderful, perfect storm, including some things on the financial end. And Jack Welch had the benefit of a lot of what Reg Jones had done. I think Flannery has the same opportunity to take some of this foundation and find different ways to make it work for the shareholders' benefit.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that this cycle of building the company and making stuff and then swinging towards making money, that it can one day like kind of come together and you can make stuff and make money at the same time. I got one last question for you, David McGee. This has been really interesting. Now, when you wrote your book, Jeff Immelt and the New GE Way, you had access to almost all of GE's leadership, right?
I did, except I didn't talk to one person, Flannery.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've been talking a lot about what shareholders think of of Immelt's tenure, but what about GE employees themselves or even the high-level, the C-suite folks you talk to? What did they make of Immelt as a CEO?
Oh, I think the respect in GE runs very deep. They understand the long haul. That does not mean they're not frustrated with the stock price, because they'd all like to retire and see their pensions deliver and stock options that they get. But the respect for Jeff Immelt runs very, very deep. Now, it's like being a pastor of a wonderful church. There still comes a time where it's best to leave, because fresh leadership can make a difference. And so Jeff is pushing himself out to a degree, because he understands that, and I think his close allies inside the company, everybody understands his mark on the company has been more profound than people may realize at the moment, and Flannery can help capitalize that in the next couple of years. But history will show Jeff guided GE through a very, very difficult period.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say that his retirement package is probably pretty good.
You're exactly right. He's bought a lot of stock. Now he's going to be cheering for the shareholder value.
Well, David McGee is author of Jeff Immelt and the New GE Way, Innovation, Transformation, and Winning in the 21st Century. David McGee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Over the past couple of months, we've been talking with Democratic aspirants to the state's highest office. They're running against Republican Charlie Baker, the governor with the highest approval rating of any governor in the country. Now, so far, we've talked with Bob Massey and Jay Gonzalez. Today, Seti Warren joins us to talk about why he's taking on Baker. Warren is the mayor of Newton, Massachusetts, and he's with me now in the studio. Mayor Warren, welcome to you.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, first of all, we usually start off these conversations by saying, give us your pitch about why you want to be a governor. But I want to do that in a slightly different way today, right?
Okay.
Because I just, you know, shout out to Newton. Great city. But some facts about Newton, Massachusetts. Median income, $122,000, mm-hmm. According to the U.S. Census Bureau. 96% of Newton residents have at least a high school degree. Only 5% of the population below the poverty level, 80% white, 3% African-American, 13% Asian. So Newton's a city that's doing really well in Massachusetts. But my question to you is, you know, it's not necessarily representative of other parts of the Commonwealth. Mm. So what makes you think that you can take that and take your experience in Newton and be a good governor for the whole of Massachusetts?
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks for those stats. Look, you know, we have the second highest number of millionaires in the state, but at the same time, 1 in 8 of our residents live at or below the poverty line. When we think about the issue, when I think about the issue of our time, the defining issue of our time, I believe it's economic inequality. And it's striking here in the greater Boston area, including in Newton. I was very lucky as a young kid that grew up in Newton. My parents grew up really in two tough neighborhoods, Harlem and the Bronx. My dad used his military GI Bill benefits from Korea to purchase the home where I grew up with my two sisters and where I live today with my wife and 9-year-old and 6-year-old with GI Bill benefits. This was a generational investment for people of modest means to make ends meet and ensure their kids can do better than they did. That is not happening in our Commonwealth today. The divide is growing. People and communities are falling behind. That's why I'm in this race.
Okay, but specifically, what could you do as governor then to close that the inequality gap? Because I mean, we've talked to the current governor, Mayor Marty Walsh, lots of other politicians from around the state. And in truth, at the, you know, maybe at the state level, perhaps there are limited things that you can do to take a bite out of this problem.
The question is, what kind of Commonwealth do we want to be? I put two proposals forward the day I announced. Free public college, we need to redefine public education. And I also propose single-payer health care. These are two drivers of economic inequality, lack of access to a strong, good, solid education so you have a skill set to compete, and health care, which is very expensive for people. And they're having to make really serious choices between health and other things. And it all starts with the state budget. On Friday, Standard & Poor's downgraded the state's bond rating. This is a very serious measure that was taken by a third-party rating agency. It's the first time Standard & Poor's has downgraded our bond rating in 30 years. Mm-hmm. It is an indication of the fact that this budget is in crisis, and it has been for a long time. We are not being direct and honest with the residents of the state of Massachusetts. Beacon Hill has not, and the governor's the lead on this budget. I've called for Mass Budget and Policy Center's proposal to ensure that we put out in a transparent way what we're spending money on now, what it takes to maintain the programs we have in place now and in the future. It starts there.
So since you brought that up, I'll just say briefly that, yes, Standard & Poor's analyst wrote on Friday, quote, that the state has not demonstrated a commitment to its adopted budget reserve policies. But it's also only one of the rating agencies. The other two have held Massachusetts at AAA.
Yeah. As a municipal leader, as a mayor, I know how serious that a downgrading is. It is a very serious thing. It means that we may not be able to implement projects, pay for services in the near future and the long term. But it's also a very serious indicator of the fact that the state, Beacon Hill, is using one-time revenue sources to keep this budget afloat. We're not being honest and direct and clear about what it takes to maintain what we have. And going furthermore, and that's Mass Budget and Policy Center's proposal, we also need to be honest about our revenue projections, which have been off in the last couple of years. I'm calling for multi-year revenue projections. I'm calling for us to look at every single expenditure in that budget, including tax expenditures that are given away to special interests, and be honest about revenue. Then we can make the investments that matter so we can deal with economic inequality in the state.
Okay, so getting back to some of those investments that matter, you say you want universal or single payer health care
yep.
in Massachusetts.
Yes.
How would you do that?
Well, look, you know, here's what I want to see out of a single payer system. I want to make sure that health outcomes are based on the health of the person. I want to make sure we have community-based care that's there, and I want to make sure it's accessible and affordable for all people. It's got to include things like mental health and dental health. Right now, our system is very expensive. As we head into the next year, the federal government is looking at cutting back on certain types of health benefits. We're in a very fluid situation.
But Mayor Warren, if I can just jump in here.
My question is specifically,
how would you make single payer work in Massachusetts? What would that look like? Would people all be paying into the state? And then, I don't understand what that means within one state.
So we have to look at various varying options, right? There are a lot of options on the table. I've been talking to a lot of healthcare experts. We certainly can look at a public option, which I think is very real and could occur here in Massachusetts. But the first question we have to ask ourselves is what kind of commonwealth do we want to be? What kind of healthcare system do we really need here in the commonwealth?
I mean, 97% of Massachusetts residents already have healthcare because of our health reform law. I mean, that in itself right now, as you well know, is that's the thing that's really under threat with all the activity going on in
Washington.
Really,
but also the accessibility question is there and the cost question is there.
Right.
When we're thinking about mental health benefits. We're dealing with a crisis in the opioid addiction area. The governor just this past year cut opioid addiction funding for Barnstable County. It's wrong. So we've got to have a healthcare system that addresses the needs of all of our residents in every part of the state. That's based on outcomes, health outcomes for people.
Yeah. You see, I'm only pressing on healthcare here because it's a huge issue for everyone personally and also as an industry and as an important point of Massachusetts leadership nationally. Yeah. But what I guess I'm not clear on is already we have the highest number of insured folks in the state. I take your point about accessibility for basic care and for mental health. I take your point. But in terms of the number of people insured, we've got the highest in the country, 97%. What I'm wondering is, given that that already exists, what's the functional difference between that and single payer? To me, it almost seems like in the Massachusetts context, single payer is kind of like a really attractive buzzword that maybe gets people to look at your ideas, but it's not functionally all that different than what we have now.
So when I hear from people making decisions between prescription drugs and affording to pay the rent, when I'm hearing people making, and this is what I've heard across the state of Massachusetts, people asking whether, contemplating whether they're going to purchase inhalers for their children or ensure that they can put food on the table. This is what I hear from families across the state. The question is, what kind of commonwealth do we want to be? Is the status quo okay? This is a driver of economic inequality. Mm-hmm. We've got to deal with it, and we can't ignore it anymore. We need to make sure we have a healthcare system in place that is affordable and accessible to all people in the Commonwealth.
Yeah. So getting back to this bond rating that you brought up, the Standard & Poor's dropping the Commonwealth's bond rating to AA from AAA. I mean, one of the reasons why that's happened is because Democratic leadership on Beacon Hill also sort of signed off on not replenishing the rainy day fund. I mean, those are folks that you would have to work with as governor. I mean, what could you say to convince them, to convince Bob DeLeo, for example, that maybe looking for new revenue streams is something the state needs? He's sworn against that.
Yeah, so a couple of things. First of all, the governor is the lead on the budget. The chief executive officer presents the budget. I also believe we need to challenge everyone at Beacon Hill, including those that are the members of my own party, to be transparent and honest about what it takes to maintain the programs we have in place right now. Right now, we have 18 days left in this budget. There's still a $500 million deficit that Beacon Hill is dealing with. There's a projected $1 billion deficit next year. In order to get to a place where you can start making decisions about where we're spending money, how we're spending money, I mentioned tax exemptions that we need to take a close look at. Billions of dollars we're giving away to special interests, and be honest about the fact we need to raise revenue. We can't get there unless we embrace what Mass Budget and Policy Center has said. Let's be honest and transparent about what it takes to fund what we're already doing. I called for this 5 months ago. My question to Beacon Hill is, if you're not going to adopt it, then why? When we're heading into another budget where we are being floated by, staying afloat by gimmicks and one-time revenue, it's wrong.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about more about you personally, if I may, sure. Because you're African American and you've actually spoken quite publicly about racial incidents in your own life, right? When you were a kid, I'm thinking about one that happened in the 1970s, and your mother was walking down a street with you and your sister. Your twin sister, by the way, right? Near Newton North.
Good research.
And I've got a great team. We come to the table prepared. And that a group of white teenagers actually threw rocks at you. Is that right?
That's true. When my parents, it was right after my parents purchased the home in 1972, that incident happened. But one of the things that came out of that incident, my dad had contacted the mayor and didn't know the mayor at all. They ended up working together on making Newton a more hospitable climate for African Americans. And it was one of the stories my father shared with me, my parents shared with me before he passed away back in 2010, is what we can do together, how we can actually turn an incident like that around. When I think about what's happening in our country right now and what's happening in the Commonwealth and the divisions that are in place right now politically, with the presidential election that's occurred, I think about the fact we've got to push back, and I'm a Democrat, lifelong Democrat. We've got to push back against these policies coming out of the Trump administration that are divisive, the Muslim ban, the federalization of police officers. We've got to push back against that, and I have, and cuts to investments for people of moderate income. At the same time, there are people that voted for President Trump that didn't vote for him for those reasons. We've got to reach out to those folks if we're going to deal with the issue of our time, which I believe is economic inequality.
Well, so let me ask you about that then. I mean, maybe you already answered it, but Anthony Brooks, our political reporter here, he did a series of reports called, 1 million Trump voters in a blue state, or 1 million red voters in a blue state. Anyway, saying that a million Massachusetts voters did vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
I mean, so tell me more specifically how you plan to reach out to them.
One of the things I did in the city of Newton, there's 7,000 people that voted for Donald Trump in the city of Newton. I put together a dinner with Clinton supporters and Trump supporters shortly after the election with the premise of how can we work together for the common good. Out of that dinner became a relationship with someone, a woman named Ginny Gardner, who was a Trump supporter, who actually worked with me to put in place a welcoming city ordinance shortly after that. And she got other Trump supporters to support that ordinance because she believed, like I believe, we shouldn't federalize our police officers. People who are undocumented in our community should not be afraid of the police. This is what we've got to do. We've got to bring people together so we can solve the very difficult problems in front of us. And I believe that the one that's in front of us is this economic inequality issue. And we've got to, Beacon Hill is not hearing people on the ground in communities across the state of Massachusetts. We have to work together as one Commonwealth if we're going to change things.
You served in the military. Tell me more about that.
1 year. I did 1 year in Iraq. I enlisted in the military a little bit after 9/11. My father was in the military, Korean War veteran. My grandfather was in the Battle of the Bulge, World War II. We have a military history in my family. I was deployed in 2007. Two things I took from that deployment. Number one was the appreciation of men and women who do multiple deployments. The second was the fact that I was embedded on this base with people that had nothing in common with me. People of different political persuasions, race, different geography. We had to work together. We couldn't afford not to, and we had to have each other's back to complete these missions we were on. And when I think about this challenge that we have in front of us politically, it's the same challenge when I talk about the divisions between Clinton supporters and Trump supporters. We have to work together. We have to look past the political differences we have, racial differences we have, religion, background, sexual orientation, and geography, and work together if we're going to change the way the Commonwealth is working and ensure it works for everyone.
Well, Seti Warren is the mayor of Newton, Massachusetts. He is running for the governorship. I'm making up words here on Radio Boston. He's thrown his hat into the race for the Massachusetts governor again. That's for 2018. Mayor Warren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And if you go to radioboston.org, listeners, by the way, you can hear our other conversations with other Democratic hopefuls for the governor's office. Again, that's at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The defense presented its case today in the trial of Michelle Carter. She's the woman charged with involuntary manslaughter related to the 2014 suicide of Conrad Roy. Prosecutors allege that Carter pushed Roy to take his own life via an onslaught of text messages and social media. WBUR senior reporter David Boeri was in the courtroom, and he joins us now. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, I understand that the defense, in making its case on behalf of Michelle Carter, called one Dr. Peter Bregan to the stand. Who is he and what's the significance of that?
Yeah, it's very interesting to see Dr. Bregan, a grandfatherly type. He's not the kind of person that strikes you as being a paid witness and consultant. He is talking animatedly about his search. He seems serious. He's going through all the records, and he's somewhat grandfatherly, which inoculates him somewhat. But remember what the prosecution has done in this case. They pose the question, you know, what kind of a person would do these things, namely the text messages that that have been shown to have been sent by Michelle Carter. What
right.
kind of a person? So what he tried to do today was to talk about that person, who she was and who she became. And that's what got really interesting, because there's two sides. There's what he called before the transformation, BT.
Uh-huh.
So let me go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Let's play that. Play that, Meg. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
It shows her to be a very vulnerable person. It shows her to be a person struggling with suicide of her own after she's begun on Prozac.
Prozac. Now, what Dr. Bregan has written about in the past is the effects of psychotherapeutic drugs on humans, and antidepressants in particular. Prozac being one of them, Celebrex being a second one, and how they affect people, and especially teenagers. So he presents this picture of her as being, as she was in her senior year, being voted most likely person to brighten your day.
Huh.
He portrays her as someone who's trying to help her friend who's dealing with suicide. She has her own problems, but she's trying to help him with his suicide. And she's working on trying to help him, and that's all the positive person. But then there is the other side, and this other side is showing the symptoms of what he calls inebriation, the inebriation being the reactions to those antidepressants, which often have pronounced effects, he testified, when they are changed, soon after they're changed, and when the dosages vary as well. So listen to what he had to say.
She is having nightmares about the devil, in which the devil actually tells her to kill herself. She is still so afraid of the devil that months later, she tells a friend that she still sleeps with her little doggy because he will scare the devil away.
So this is Michelle Carter after the transformation, but only after the transformation. And it shows she's gone, what he said, she has gone grandiose on us, referring to how she responded, he says, to those drugs. But this was the pre-transformation Carter he described earlier,
yeah.
A completely different personality. Listen to this.
She's constantly cheering him up as best she can. She feels deeply responsible for him, which is a characteristic of her in regard to other people. Part of it is her strength, but part of it is her vulnerability, that she just needs to be engaged with people to help them.
David, let me just jump in here. Is what I'm hearing that the defense in part is arguing that Michelle Carter was trying to help Conrad Roy?
Yes, that she is, and this is consistent with her personality, according to Dr. Bregan. Someone is described as helping people, wanting to help people. Meanwhile, she has her own troubles. She's launched into trying to rescue him. the defense would argue, when he is dragging her down and he comes across in the portrayal here as being cold and unhelping to her. She's trying to reach him. She has the reaction. This is the chain of reaction here, that she has the reaction to the antidepressants. And listen to this. In July 2014, suddenly the transformation, and you want to go dark, listen to this.
She has an involuntary intoxication where she is not forming a criminal intent, I'm going to harm him. She's not doing something she thinks is criminal, this is bad. She's found the way to use her unique power to help and to love.
And again, David, so this is the defense.
Love. Sending him to his suicide to show how much she loves him, because this is the way, in her distorted thinking, obviously, brought on by the antidepressants, they would say.
So quite a defense here.
How
did prosecutors react to the testimony given by Dr. Breggin?
Prosecution has been apoplectic, but the hard-charging, one-directional prosecutor, Katie Rayburn, has her hands full of the grandfatherly medical expert who continues on the point. He's unflappable, and she is growing more and more frustrated in her cross-examination of him.
Well, that's WBUR's David Boeri speaking to us about the latest in the trial of Michelle Carter. David, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Finally today, something completely different. Let's wrap up the show with our regular Common Health segment. And joining us is Carrie Goldberg. She's host of WBUR's Common Health Blog. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so you are our health guru reporter. Most of the time you come in and talk to us about the latest studies on various diseases, but today something sweeter. I need something sweeter.
Sweeter and lighter. It's chocolate milk.
Yum.
Yep, or rather the long-running fight over chocolate milk and whether we should sell it in our schools.
Okay, so I have to come clean with everyone here. I got school lunch. Yeah. I bought lunch at school when I was in elementary school every day, and I drank chocolate milk.
And you're okay.
Every single day. So what's the problem?
So, of course, the problem is sugar, right? So it has added sugar, and with the country fighting an obesity epidemic, well, we've stopped since your day, probably. We stopped selling soda in our schools,
yeah,
right? So some people are arguing we should not sell sweetened milk. Now, of course, soda was a much easier call because soda has no nutritional value whatsoever, right?
But chocolate milk at least has the milk in it.
Right. It has the milk. It's trickier because it does have nutritional value. It has calcium, has vitamin D and other nutrients. And yet it has this added sugar.
Okay, so here we have the fundamental problem, familiar to many. Mm-hmm. You want your kids to eat healthy foods, but at the same time, maybe a little sweetness helps them eat those foods,
it's
right?
It's the proverbial spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. That's right. So, but of course, sugar, at least in excess, is looking more and more like a nutritional villain lately, right? So what do you do? And this dilemma over chocolate milk, it's been going on for years now. It seems to be splitting school districts around the country. And there was a big conference on school nutrition at Harvard last week. It's called Healthy Food Fuels Hungry Minds. And I spoke with the head of Houston School Food. She's her name is Betty Wiggins, and she's actually famous for revolutionizing Detroit school food. She's been called the rebel lunch lady. So like lunch ladies can be heroines. They're not just villains,
yeah,
like in Captain Underpants, right? So, and now she's in Houston, and I asked for her position on chocolate milk.
I don't find it necessary to serve children chocolate milk simply because of the sugar. Chocolate milk is a treat. You don't need flavored milk. It's just a response, I believe, to the market. And there's fellow food service directors around the country who feel the same way I do.
So there are food directors around the country who feel that way, but there
yeah.
are also plenty of school food directors who feel that chocolate and flavored milks are just fine. And in fact, one widely cited estimate is that 70% of the milk drunk in schools is flavored. So you are not an outlier, Megan.
Oh, thank goodness.
You were typical, yes. And this debate actually extends all the way to the world of pediatricians, too. So the American Academy of Pediatrics, the leading pediatric body, it came out strongly for limiting fruit juices for kids because they're so high in sugar, they just recommended against fruit juice for kids under age one. But Dr. Steve Abrams, the incoming chair of their nutrition committee, says they're actually okay with some flavored milks in the schools.
The manufacturers have brought down the amount of sugar in chocolate milk quite a bit in recent years. And, again, it's not necessarily as good as white milk because it does have more sugar, but we don't think that flavored milk should be entirely removed. And if you take all the flavored milks out of school, then you will tend to decrease the amount of milk that children are drinking.
What do the sugar absolutists have to say about that?
We'll get to that. First, let's hear the other side of the pediatricians. Like, this is Dr. Diane Dooley. She's a pediatrician in the San Francisco Bay Area. And she's the sugar absolutist you just asked about. She co-authored a letter of protest to the Academy's big journal, Pediatrics. And she's very concerned about all the sugar in chocolate and flavored milks.
The kids that I see in my practice who are all low income are not just drinking sugared flavored milk once a day at school. Sometimes they're drinking it two times or three times a day at school because there's a breakfast, a lunch, and then there's a snack. And then they're drinking it at home in part because it becomes an expectation that if the school thinks this is healthy, then the family should be offering it too.
And Dr. Dooley used this analogy that struck me as really powerful. She says, okay, we know we want our kids to eat fruit, right? But that doesn't mean the schools should serve them candy apples, right? She says same thing with sugared milk.
Well, I mean, and with that analogy, it's like sugared milk is a liquefied candy bar, right? Okay. That, according to one view,
right?
I'm going to say this, but so what's the latest in this dilemma slash debate?
So in recent weeks, the Trump administration, which is promising to make school lunches great again. And last month, let's not go there, okay? So they're promising to do that. And last month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced an upcoming change in the guidelines on school milk. So right now, the guidelines say flavored milks and chocolate milks have to be skim milks to cut the calories in a serving. But the new Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, says that now flavored milks can have 1% fat.
Okay, so 1% milk. So the additional fat content would make it taste better.
Right, which means more kids will be drinking sweetened milks, which you might think is good or bad, but obviously it doesn't address the sugar issue. But you know what would address the sugar issue? Well, I spoke at this Harvard conference to Dariush Muzaffarian. He's the dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy.
One of the main challenges is that whole milk is gone from school. But I think that healthier foods with more calories are better for kids. It's better to have 100 calories of nuts or 100 calories of broccoli than 80 calories of soda. And similarly, I think it's better to have whole milk than to have chocolate skim milk with a little bit fewer calories. So I think we should get whole milk back in schools, which kids like to drink. And the science doesn't strongly support a focus on skim milk over whole milk for kids.
So he's arguing to bring back plain whole milk. Now, I have to admit, Meghna, I didn't even know that whole milk is barred from public schools.
I did not know that either, to be perfectly honest. But this makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, whole milk tastes great for people who can drink it. I know that there's a lot of people who can't. But you know, it makes perfect sense. So why not?
Yep. Right. And also, you know, we're in the midst of this gigantic pendulum shift away from fat as the enemy, quote unquote, and more towards sugar in excess as being of concern. And Dariush Muzaffarian says the trouble is also that we tend to have these really simplistic ideas about specific nutrients and what they do for us. And that's how he says we got into this situation.
We need calcium, we need vitamin D, so we should have 3 servings of dairy. We want to avoid calories and fat, so we should have skim milk. That makes sense if you kind of have an isolated reductionist view of food, but we are learning that foods are really complicated. Yogurt has probiotics in it, and milk has many other types of fatty acids, many other nutrients beyond calcium and vitamin D. So I think we need to move away from the low-fat, high-fat focus for dairy.
So maybe a little high-fat milk in moderation could actually be okay. And by the way, Meghna, at this conference was Professor Marion Nethel. She's a real giant on food policy and politics. She went even a step further. She says, yes, chocolate milk should be seen as like a dessert, like a treat, like a cookie. And she even says that if kids end up drinking less milk, that doesn't particularly worry her. She says there are plenty of kids who are lactose intolerant.
Like I said.
And they have very nutritious diets. You can get those nutrients elsewhere.
Okay, so Maybe then if we do this right, then kids won't grow up like I did, and I'm like addicted to chocolate, like hot chocolates these days. Like all winter long, every day I take a break in the middle of the morning and I gotta go get my hot chocolate.
Well, it's also another source for parental guilt because you're supposed to educate your kids' palate not to need the sweetness, and I blew that.
Good. Well, that was really fascinating. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to her story on the Chocolate Milk Wars. That's all at radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.